Good morning. You are listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks. In our current political climate, there has been a growing movement to elect, quote, progressive, end quote, prosecutors. There has also been growing critique and analysis around whether or not such a thing exists, as prosecutors are the driving force behind who does or does not go to jail and prison. We are in conversation this morning with Emily Bazelon, who explores all of this in her book, Charged, The New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. Ms. Bazelon is a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine, the Truman Capote Fellow for Creative Writing and Law, and a lecturer at Yale Law School. Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So let's jump right in. What role do prosecutors play in the mass incarceration matrix that is often not spoken about?
Well, so prosecutors in the 1980s got a lot more discretion and power than they'd had before. And what I'm talking about is this transition in which people fear rising crime and politicians change the sentencing laws. In particular, they pass a lot of mandatory minimum sentences for a whole bunch of crimes.
This is in correlation with the crack epidemic, right?
Yeah, exactly. The crack epidemic comes into play and, you know, the homicide rate was rising at the time. So it was a real concern. What you see, however, in these mandatory minimum sentences are this kind of unspoken passing of power from judges to prosecutors. And what I mean by that is that when you have a mandatory sentence, that's the floor. That means that what you decide to charge and the plea bargain you offer, that's where you decide what the punishment is going to be. And charging and plea bargaining are decisions that prosecutors make without judges almost entirely. And so without, I think, really meaning to, we shifted a lot of power and discretion from judges who are, you know, supposed to be impartial, that's their job, to prosecutors who are usually primarily motivated by the desire to win convictions.
So what roles do judges play?
Well, judges, you know, still make important decisions, especially at trial, and they make decisions about what evidence to admit. But in a lot of cases, these considerations don't even come up. So somewhere around 95% or more, convictions are obtained through plea bargains, not through trials. So trials have become extremely rare in the American judicial system, even though we see them all the time on TV. And even questions about evidence, the way the law works and the way case processing works, prosecutors have tons of cases on their desks, so do defense lawyers. Often nobody really focuses on the facts and what should be admitted before a trial until months have passed and someone has charges facing them for those months, that person might also be in jail because they can't afford to make bail. So there's a lot of decision making and kind of basic routine processing that happens that judges have very little part in.
To your point about trials not happening very often, we had a public defender here in the Bay Area that recently passed, Jeff Adachi. And that was actually one of his strategies to push back on this, was that he would take it to trial, which really made the cops and the prosecutors pretty angry.
Jeff Adachi is a really singular figure around the country. He was one of the only elected public defenders. And he was an elected public defender in a city that is quite liberal and respected his independence and valued it in a way that I'm not sure would really translate outside of a lot of places that are different from San Francisco. Mm. So it is true that there are other aggressive public defenders' offices who take more cases to trial. The problem with that strategy is, so first of all, it really depends on the kind of jury you can expect to have. In a lot of communities, juries tend to be more white and more privileged than the defendants, so it's not necessarily a jury of your peers exactly. And then the other issue is that the way charging works in a lot of prosecutors' offices, the prosecutor will say, okay, if you accept this plea bargain and spare me all the work of a trial, I'll give you, say, 1 year sentence, a 2 year sentence, a 5 year sentence on a robbery. But if you make me go to trial, I am going to ask for a much, much heavier penalty if you lose. And that kind of gamble is really hard for defendants to take because they know they're risking their freedom, even something like a life sentence.
Right. And particularly when you're talking about black and brown folks who, you know, walk into the situation knowing that a fair shake in the criminal justice system is not a given for them. You know, folks, we find folks that are pleading to things that they really maybe didn't do or could have gotten a lighter sentence for just to avoid what they fear could be the maximum outcome at a trial.
Right, exactly. And I think that, you know, that is a really urgent and live concern that people have, and it makes sense that they have it. I mean, I encountered cases in my reporting in which people were going to prison for decades because they'd gambled on going to trial and then they had lost.
So, you know, mass incarceration is sort of a buzzword now. I mean, and it's a mainstream fight. And by that, I mean, you know, foundations are funding it. You know, we have Joy DeGruz and The New Jim Crow. We had the film 13th. There are organizations across the country that are working to try to reverse what happened in the 80s and 90s. But none of sort of the movements have really focused on going after prosecutors as being a primary tool to interrupt the funneling of bodies into America's prisons. Where did this conversation start to percolate, and how did it sort of, you know, explode into some major national campaigns that have been happening the last couple of years?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say that it started to percolate when a law professor named Angela Davis, not that Angela Davis.
Oh,
though,
so you got to clarify. This is a Bay Area station. You say Angela Davis, we just assume there's one.
People know, but that Angela, well, anyway, okay, my Angela Davis and my story is Angela J. Davis,
that's
different
right.
Black
it
woman.
Is in your book.
She wrote a book called Arbitrary Justice about the power of prosecutors more than 10 years ago. This Angela Davis had been the head of the Public Defender Services in Washington, D.C., and she had seen the way this power dynamic operates. Then you see a couple of other academics, a professor at Harvard named Bill Stuntz, and then more recently a professor at Fordham named John Pfaff. They pick up this argument, and John in particular made a bunch of empirical advances by looking at the charging decisions prosecutors make in this giant database of state court cases that no one had really examined before. And so you see this work by academics really give evidence to this notion that prosecutors are running the show in a lot of places. And then in around 2015, the Black Lives Matter movement is trying to figure out what can it deliver to its people, right? Like, there have been a bunch of protests around the country, a lot of unrest, a lot of fury towards public officials and the criminal justice system, but not a whole lot of like tangible benefit. And one of the answers to that question is, okay, let's look at the local DA's office. This is a person whose power really lies in the hand of local voters. So what happens if we try to energize communities of color around choosing a new kind of prosecutor? And so in November 2016, you know, we all woke up and President Trump had been elected, and that was like sent giant shockwaves through the country. But when I took a step back and started looking at the results of these local DA races, what I saw was that about a dozen candidates promising to reduce mass incarceration and reduce reliance on cash bail really changed the system. They had won office in some big cities around the country. And you've seen a kind of growth in that movement since then.
I need to make one correction before we move on. The new Jim Crow is Michelle Alexander. It is not Joy DeGruz. So, okay. And so now there's this movement that's also been sort of uplifted by Color of Change, right? And their partnership, which is one of the largest media outlets that reaches Black folks and progressive folks. And they've really used their platform to fuel this movement.
Yes, you're right. Color of Change has become this very energized civil rights group that has this big online following. And they are kind of a national player in this movement. The way it works in some cities is that local groups really get the ball rolling in terms of organizing around a progressive candidate for DA. And then Color of Change helps because they've participated in these races in different places. So they can bring the expertise that they've built from around the country and really add to the efforts of local groups.
So I started this segment by talking about that part of the debate is around, is there such a thing as a progressive prosecutor? Because at the end of the day, prosecutors do send people to prison. And so particularly here in the Bay Area, where, you know, there's a lot of committed abolitionists and folks that are deeply entrenched in abolitionist theory, they struggle with this concept. But I wanted to hear from you in terms of like, what types of changes have we seen in cities that have elected reform minded district attorneys?
That's a great question. So you're starting to see things like a real reduction in the number of people who are in jail before they go to trial when they're presumed innocent because they can't afford bail. So we're seeing that population go down, for example, from Brooklyn, and that's contributing to a reduction in the number of people at Rikers Island, which is a notoriously violent jail in New York City. You're also seeing a willingness to challenge the police. That's happening in places like Boston and Philadelphia around questions, for example, like, if a police officer has a history of lying on the stand, should they be called to testify in future cases? Like, what do we do about that? So that is a real shift in the power dynamic, because traditionally prosecutors really work hand in hand with the police officers and are very reluctant to do anything that might get the cops mad.
Are we seeing flare-ups between progressive prosecutors and police departments or police associations?
Yeah, we are seeing flare-ups like that. When Larry Krasner, who's the new DA in Philadelphia, was elected in 2017, one of the local police associations representing the rank and file said it was going to be a catastrophe for the city. Very recently, this week, there's been this release of social media postings by police officers in a variety of cities. And Krasner said, when a lot of some of those posts revealed that Philadelphia cops were saying things that were racist or anti-Muslim, that he was having serious doubts about using those officers to testify. So again, a kind of willingness to say to the police, we are not going to abide by all of this behavior.
There was also, in terms of tensions between progressive prosecutors and police, the fairly recent, what popped up around the Jussie Smollett case in Chicago, where the Police Officer Association really came after Kimberly Fox, who was put in office by People's Movement to oust the former conservative DA, Anita Alvarez.
Yeah, that's a really interesting story. I'm glad you brought that up. So Smollett obviously got in trouble for what looks like faking a hate crime. And then he was criminally prosecuted. And at first, Fox recused herself, took herself out of the case, and her office brought many different felony charges against him, seeming like they were really throwing the book at him and making an example of him. Then they backed off and they let Smollett take a plea bargain that in which he didn't even admit his guilt. And other than forfeiting the $10,000 in bond that he'd paid, he didn't face any kinds of consequences. And that was very controversial in Chicago. Fox's defense is that she wanted to treat Smollett the way she would treat anyone else, and she thought that anyone else would have gotten this same kind of deal. There were questions about her decision in the end, what looked like she had not actually recused herself or she had changed her mind about that, and that is not something that prosecutors are really supposed to do. So she's been under criticism for that, and there's now a whole investigation going on in her office.
I just wonder, were she not a progressive prosecutor, were it not that the Chicago Police Department, another notoriously violent police department, saw her as a threat, if they would have come so hard for her?
I think that that's totally a valid question to ask. And, you know, we've seen this in other cities, especially, I have to say, with progressive claiming prosecutors who are also people of color, where police associations have called on them to resign. I'm thinking of Fox, but also Rachel Rollins in Boston and a DA named John Cruzeau in Dallas. And you see this pattern, and it's hard not to think, like, okay, in exactly the way you were talking about, would the criticism be this sharp and extreme? Would people be calling for the resignation of prosecutors who were not seen as progressive and thus a threat to the status quo?
You were listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks. I'm in conversation with Emily Bazelon about her book, Charged, The New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. Emily, your book follows two people and two cases. Why did you choose this format, the storytelling format, really rooted in the stories of Kevin and Nora?
You know, we started off talking about the work of academics and social movements. And what I can bring to this conversation as a journalist is the power of storytelling, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's my job. It's to explain what's happening, but also kind of show you what is happening to individual people in hopes that you'll care about them. And, you know, I often feel when I'm in criminal court that if everybody could see what I'm seeing, they would experience it as an injustice and want to do something about it. And so a lot of what I do is just bear witness. And I told these two stories in an effort to do just that.
Well, let's tell some stories then. Let's start with Kevin. Who is he and what happened to him?
Kevin is a really typical 19, 20-year-old black kid growing up in a poor neighborhood in Brooklyn. His story is that one night he was over at a friend's apartment. The friend had a gun that, you know, Kevin had noticed when he walked in the room. The gun was just lying on the table. In New York, if you have a gun without a license, you can go to prison for years just for possessing the gun. So all of a sudden the cops knocked on the door and Kevin happened to be standing there like about to go outside and so actually opened it. And he had this split second in which to make a decision. He knew that his friend who owned the apartment had a felony record and he knew enough about the law to know that that friend would probably go to prison for a long time if he got caught with the gun. And so Kevin had this kind of rash idea. It's like shows you, you know, both like his age and also that right. He didn't have much time to think. He had this notion, oh, I'm going to pick up this gun and flush it down the toilet.
I'm sorry, it's not funny.
I know, I understand your reaction. So, of course, that did not work. And instead, what happened was that he got arrested and charged for possession of this gun and found himself facing a potential 15-year prison sentence and a mandatory minimum sentence of 3 years. So this is all happening in Brooklyn, which is a place with a newly elected prosecutor who claims to be a progressive. And I watched this case go through the system to sort of look at these questions. Okay, what does it mean to have a DA making these kinds of promises when you have someone who's facing what in New York is treated as a serious violent felony? Like, how is this all going to play out? And Kevin gets a kind of second chance. And then I wanted to see him go through the program that allows for that second chance to see what's going to happen to him.
And then there's Nora Jackson. This is a very different story. So Kevin gets a second chance. What happens with Nora?
Kevin's story, I was trying to write about the very ordinary kind of prosecutorial power. Nora's case is about a prosecutor in Memphis named Amy Weirich, and Weirich charges Nora with the murder of Nora's own mother after Nora's mother is brutally stabbed to death in the middle of the night. And Nora's only 18 at the time. She has no criminal history. There's no history of abuse in the family. It's very unusual for a child to murder a parent in this kind of circumstance. But Weirich makes this charging decision. Then the DNA results from the crime scene come back, and they actually exclude Nora's DNA from the crime scene. There are two unknown suspects whose full DNA profiles are showing up in the lab results, but they're not Nora. That doesn't change Amy Weirich's mind. Nora does take the gamble of going to trial, and she gets convicted by the jury. Weirich is a very skilled trial lawyer. Lots of evidence comes in that's effectively like character assassination evidence about Nora's drug use and like even her having sex with her boyfriend. And she gets more than a 20-year prison sentence. So I followed this case to look at this example of a prosecutor really pushing to convict someone in a high-profile case and then breaking the rules to do that. Because it turns out that Nora's conviction gets overturned by the Tennessee Supreme Court because Amy Weirich and her co-counsel did not disclose evidence that the Tennessee Supreme Court said could have helped Nora prove her innocence.
I mean, gosh, you've spoken about New York and you've talked about this prosecutor breaking the rules, and I can't help but uplift what is on the minds and hearts of a lot of Black folks and progressive folks, I think, right now, which is Ava DuVernay's depiction of what happened to the Central Park Five and the prosecutor in that case and the railroading those young men by both police and prosecutors.
Right. I mean, look, I want to say that I think most prosecutors have really high ethical standards and do not go around in any way trying to convict innocent people, right? Like, that's not something that almost anyone does deliberately. However, I think there is a righteousness that can come with having this kind of power in which people don't want to admit they're wrong. And, you know, when you think about it from the point of view of a prosecutor who makes that kind of error, you can see it would be terrible to think that you had ruin someone's life, sent them to prison when in fact, like, the real killer is still out there. So I think that's one reason why we see a lot of resistance to admitting that you get something wrong. But we also see in Ava DuVernay's work, you know, the just devastating consequences that has.
Being a progressive prosecutor can have its pitfalls as well. DAs are elected positions. What are some of the things that they worry about in terms of trying to do things differently? What can come back to bite them?
Well, you know, the typical problem we faced forever in the American criminal justice system is that someone gets out of jail, they get some kind of break, and then they commit a terrible crime. And all reform comes to a screeching halt, right? This is the story of, like, the Willie Horton ad that helped right. George H.W. Bush get elected president. And we have made so much criminal justice policy in America in reaction to the one terrible outlier case.
Right.
So what I see now among these prosecutors who are trying to be progressive is that they will say up front, look, things are going to go wrong. Like, it's not going to all go perfectly. And you're going to have to bear with me when things go wrong. I think, you know, Kim Fox could be making this argument right now in Chicago. And so that is one big problem, I think, that progressive prosecutors face. And we're still in a moment right now where crime rates are falling across the country. And I think that explains part of the willingness of the American public to think about ending mass incarceration and doing things differently. If those crime rates start to go back up and people feel scared, that window may close.
I was thinking about the importance of this movement in this particular political climate. You know, I remember when former AG Jeff Sessions was appointed, like, one of his first sort of calls to action was, you know, sort of setting up the memo to prosecutors across the country to bring in more convictions, right? And we've got a president
yes.
that is, you know, utilizing his platform to stoke the very types of stereotypes that lead to mass incarceration of black and brown people. And where do you see this movement situated in the context of that political climate?
So I see the dynamics you're talking about. They are very real. And from the point of view of President Trump, what we see is an exaggeration about the violence and criminality of immigrants, right? Which is a really both a false and a very problematic stereotype. I also, though, see real bipartisan support for criminal justice reform. You can see red states like Texas and Oklahoma passing pretty meaningful changes in the law. When I started working on my book, I found this Wall Street Journal op-ed by Grover Norquist, who's famous for, you know, getting everybody in Congress to sign a pledge that they will never raise taxes. He's like a strong fiscal conservative, and he claimed criminal justice reform as one of the primary achievements of the conservative movement. So there is a shift going on. You know, even with President Trump, he signed the bipartisan criminal justice reform bill that passed in Congress. Like, he signed it with a lot of fanfare. He's called attention to it. Now, it's small potatoes in terms of actually getting people out of jail and prison. But in terms of the national narrative about, you know, what do we think about crime? Should we be showing mercy? How do we feel about second chances for people who have been accused of crimes? Like, those are significant developments.
In addition to ending mass funneling of people into prisons, what other reforms need to happen to sort of interrupt what I actually call the womb to prison pipeline?
Yeah, that's a really good question, too. I mean, one thing that we don't talk about enough are fees and fines, mm-hmm. like all the ways in which people are financially burdened by the criminal justice system. And that can really set people back financially. You can wind up in jail because you owe debt, sometimes even to like a private probation or processing company. Mm-hmm. So those, the financial hole that criminal justice consequences can create, that can take people years to climb out of. And it's a really serious issue.
These relatively new progressive prosecutors, are they sort of banding together in any way to create lasting change in the system?
They are trying to. And this is so important because traditionally and still, for the most part, the state associations for district attorneys almost always lobby in favor of harsher punishment and more incarceration. Like, that's part of what they do. They go to their state capital and they say, like, give us more tools to put people away. So when you have a kind of counterpart to that, when you have prosecutors lining up on the other side and saying, no, actually, you know, for example, in Washington State, like, there is a district attorney in Seattle who called for ending the death penalty. That's a really important shift in the dynamic because you have law enforcement voices on both sides of the debate.
Emily, you end the introduction of your book by writing, quote, "In time, the country's embrace of mass incarceration in its vast cruelty may come to seem as nearly as shameful as slavery does now," end quote. Say more about that statement.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big claim to make, and I thought a lot about it. You know, I was inspired by Michelle Alexander's argument in The New Jim Crow that the criminal justice system is so permeated by racism that it is effectively operating as a kind of legal system of racial oppression. And when you think of the criminal justice system that way, and you think of the millions of people whose lives are affected by it, it starts to feel like, wait a second, we're going to look back on this and we're going to think, okay, there were 2 million people in prison in the year 2019. There are 10 million kids across the country who, by the time they're 18, they're going to have experienced a parent who's been incarcerated. We have 70 million people with criminal records in this country, if you count everybody who's been arrested. That's as many people as go to four-year colleges. Those numbers are so big, and I think the damage that the system does to people's lives, the way it takes away potential and opportunity for people's futures, like that just started to feel very present and vivid to me. And so that's the reason that I wrote that passage.
You are listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks. We have been in conversation with Emily Bazelon about her book, Charged, The New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. Ms. Bazelon is a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine, the Truman Capote Fellow for Creative Writing and Law, and a lecturer at Yale Law School. Emily, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much for your great questions. I really appreciate it.